Today's podcast is kindly sponsored by Boyne Valley Honey. Boyne Valley Honey is Ireland's favourite honey brand, and one of my daily healthy habits is incorporating Boyne Valley Honey into my daily routine. The health benefits of honey have been used for centuries. Honey acts as a natural remedy for cough and also has natural antimicrobial properties. I add Boyne Valley Squeezy Honey to my porridge every morning. Thank you, Boyne Valley Honey, for supporting this series of my podcast. I hope you enjoy listening today. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Hugh O'Connor, consultant obstetrician and gynaecologist at the Coombe Hospital. He has just recently finished a two-year fellowship in advanced reproductive and reconstructive pelvic surgery at Monash Health in Melbourne, Australia. Dr. O'Connor went on to do a travelling fellowship with Professor Mauricio Abrao, a world-renowned expert in the management of deeply infiltrating endometriosis. And that is what we're here to talk about today, is endometriosis. Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. O'Connor. I really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to me today about endometriosis.
Good afternoon, Darren. Thank you very much for having me.
So can we just, I suppose we'll start with the basics. What is endometriosis and what causes it?
Well, endometriosis, it's not a terribly well understood condition, but it is very common and has a major impact on women globally. It is thought to affect about 10% of women of reproductive age at any one time. And in those women who are struggling to conceive, that's actually up to about 50% in those women. There's several theories about what causes it, but there's no kind of single proven understanding of it. The oldest theory was that this theory of retrograde menstruation, that when women are having their periods, that some of the menstrual flow goes back through the fallopian tubes and spills into the pelvic cavity. And that in some women that implants into the tissues around their pelvis and causes endometriosis. And while it still remains a very plausible explanation, it doesn't fully understand it and it doesn't fully explain it, and certainly not in all cases. So some more recent studies have looked into that actually the origins of endometriosis happen within fetal life. When in fetal life, we have a thing called Mullerian tracts on either side, which join together to form the uterus. And that those cells that are in those tracts that will go on to form the endometrium, the lining of the uterus, that some of those become displaced and then lie dormant outside of the uterus around the pelvis. And that when that woman reaches adulthood and puberty, that's stimulated into developing endometriosis.
Okay, because endometriosis, I guess it most commonly occurs in the pelvis, but it can occur anywhere in the body, can't it?
Absolutely, and endometriosis outside the pelvis, the most common. Most commonly will be in the abdominal cavity and where it is just spread locally through the fluid in the abdomen. But it's also found in distant sites. I mean, it can be found in the lungs, in the brain, in the heart even. It's not well understood at all.
Yeah.
It is thought that does it spread through the lymphatic system? Does it spread through the blood system? Is it that there's, stem cells with the ability to develop into endometrial type tissue that are circulating, arising from the bone marrow?
It's fascinating. So yeah, the fact that it occurs in distant sites that takes away from the retrograde menstruation kind of idea, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that certainly debunks that as a kind of a unifying theory.
Yes. So endometriosis is the lining of the womb. So that's the endometrium, the lining of the womb. Ordinarily, in women without endometriosis, would just be contained within the womb. But for women with endometriosis, that endometrium is in other parts of the body.
Yeah, and that's a very straightforward way of explaining it. Now, it must be said that it's like endometrial tissue, but it's not quite the same. And then when we've studied endometriosis tissue and endometrium, there are differences. It's a more it's more pro-inflammatory tissue, but it does have a lot of the same characteristics as endometrial tissue.
Okay, very interesting. And how is it different to adenomyosis?
That's a fantastic question. And adenomyosis is something I'm very interested in and something I don't think that is given enough attention by the medical community and even within gynecology. So at one point they were considered the same condition, but they're certainly related and there's huge overlap. Adenomyosis is where you see that abnormal endometrial tissue developing within the muscle of the womb, within the myometrium. So classically, a woman with adenomyosis will get painful, heavy periods. That's the classic symptom. She'll typically have a bulkier than normal uterus. She may have some irregular menstrual bleeding, bleeding between her periods. Whereas with endometriosis, where that tissue is outside of the uterus, most commonly around the pelvis, they tend to have painful periods, but not necessarily heavy periods. Painful intercourse is obviously a really common symptom of endometriosis. And with adenomyosis, the pain that they experience of intercourse is often not necessarily during it, but it is often a crampy pain afterwards. Now, there's quite a degree of overlap. So many women will have both. And the adenomyosis you'll most commonly see in women who have endometriosis in their 30s and 40s rather than women in their teens or 20s.
Okay, so adenomyosis, it's the abnormal kind of endometrial tissue, but in the muscle of the womb. Okay, so that's how it's different. So you went through some of the symptoms there. So just going back again to endometriosis, like what are the classical symptoms of endometriosis? So it's the it's painful periods, not necessarily heavier periods. What else is there for endometriosis? What symptoms might suggest that a person might have it?
Painful periods, and it often starts off as that, and it might be that a woman reports that in her teens that her periods are very painful for a day or two during it. As time goes on, it might be lasting longer. It might be on the days running up to her period, right the way through it, and for a number of days afterwards. And we describe that as cyclical pelvic pain, that it is in keeping with her cycle. But very often, if that goes on for long enough, it often becomes to that she experiences pain more often during the month. And it's more of a chronic pelvic pain. Painful intercourse. And it, that's usually described as a deep pain with with intercourse. It is really common. And that might, again, be worse at various times in her cycle. Women will often notice that the, say, if a woman has recently stopped the oral contraceptive pill, she might notice these symptoms, and it might be for the first time. So some women will have these, you know, right from when they start having periods in their teens, whereas other women might be, you know, she's in her 20s or 30s, she takes a break from her contraceptive pill and suddenly these symptoms come along. Pain with having a bowel motion is quite common, or pain after passing urine or urinary frequency. And these are all symptoms and that can arise in endometriosis and often suggest that the endometriosis is, say, impacting near the bowel, near the bladder. Pain radiating down the legs can often indicate that it's irritating some of the nerves within the pelvis.
Okay, fascinating. So, yeah, we have to think of bowel and bladder symptoms as well. So a lot of pelvic symptoms there. Does it have an impact on quality of life for people who are suffering with it?
Absolutely. And it's the delay to diagnosis is quite significant. It's a, probably approximately 9 years from the time a woman first reports these symptoms to achieving a diagnosis. And it can be, you know, longer in some instances. And in that time, I suppose people certainly impacts on their mental health, their ability to attend school, participate in sport, perform well at their at their work, have relationships, have children. So it's difficult to estimate exactly how much it affects the quality of life, but it really is enormous.
So you mentioned there about the delay to diagnosis, and can you give some insight as to why it takes such a long time from when you initially report your symptoms, probably to your GP in the first instance. Why is there such a long time between that initial reporting of symptoms up to the diagnosis of endometriosis?
I think probably because the symptoms initially are reasonably subtle. Some pain, you know, with your period. And most women will say they get some pain with their periods, but how much is too much? And that's not something that I think, you know, women themselves amongst each other kind of have a good understanding of.
Yeah.
One woman's pain might be related to another, might be woman's
all
a mild cramp.
Yeah, we all have different like pain thresholds and we feel pain differently,
And often, particularly in younger women, people are maybe reluctant to investigate or treat women, particularly who are young. There's often no features at an early stage on ultrasound or on examination. There's no obvious signs. The definitive way to do a diagnosis in most cases is a laparoscopy. So that's keyhole surgery to look inside the pelvis. And the major downside of that is it is an invasive procedure and it's not one that is completely without risk.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. And I think that because oftentimes I do get younger patients mostly who come in and they say, I think I have endometriosis. I've read about it. I think I have it. I want to be tested for it. And, you know, obviously I tease out the symptoms with them, but people are often very surprised that like the definitive diagnosis is made with laparoscopic surgery, basically, which will require a general anaesthetic. So that's, you know, that's a big undertaking and that isn't done lightly. So people are often surprised that we can't really diagnose it by physical exam, blood tests or ultrasound.
Yeah, I mean, there's different manifestations of it. There is there's deeply infiltrating endometriosis where you have bulky nodular disease which affecting the bowel or the outside of the womb, where if you do an ultrasound or an MRI, you can visualize that because there's a bulk to it. You can also get endometriosis-related cysts of the ovary, endometriomas we call them, or chocolate cysts. And they're quite easy to pick up usually on ultrasound. But the most common manifestation is superficial endometriosis of the peritoneum. That's the lining of the pelvis.
Yeah.
That's the most common manifestation. And it's very difficult to see on imaging. And even with examination, you'll find that if you do a pelvic examination, there might be tender during it, but that you don't feel anything abnormal, that you don't feel nodules, and there's no sign that the womb is stuck or anything like that. And for those patients, unfortunately, the laparoscopy is going to be the definitive test.
Yes.
So even if a woman has had imaging and it doesn't show anything, if her story is suggestive of endometriosis and there's no other obvious cause, then it is always worthwhile considering, is a laparoscopy warranted here?
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned there as well about when we were talking about quality of life, how endometriosis can affect fertility. And that's possibly how some people find out that they have it, is it, when they're trying to conceive and it's not happening. So, you know, in terms of fertility, can women with endometriosis naturally conceive, or how does it affect fertility?
Yeah, it's really interesting. How does it do that? And endometriosis, I often think them simply, patients with it, I can consider in two groups. There are those who present because they've pain, they've symptoms suggestive of endometriosis. And then there's those women who present because they don't particularly have symptoms, but they're trying to get pregnant and it's not happening. And we know that in those women, about 50% will find endometriosis in. It's difficult to explain fully how it affects fertility. But first of all, being able to have a normal pattern of sexual intercourse is difficult.
Yeah.
That's one. It can physically distort the anatomy of the pelvis.
Okay.
And it can prevent the fallopian tubes working in a mechanical way. It's potential that they're simply blocked as a result of endometriosis. But also, endometriosis is an inflammatory condition. And when you have this inflammatory environment within the pelvis, that inhibits that affects the ability of the ovaries to function as they should. It affects the ability of the fallopian tubes to transport a fertilized egg as they should. And it also affects the lining of the womb to and reduce the chance that you have implantation of an embryo. So there's quite a few factors to it. But the good news, I suppose, is that the majority of women with endometriosis will get pregnant.
That is great news.
It's not all bad news.
Yeah.
Being diagnosed with endometriosis does not mean you will never be able to have, have babies.
That's really important for people to hear.
Even if it's on the more severe end of the spectrum, they can. The majority will still ultimately get pregnant. Now, that said, more women who have endometriosis will require assistance to get pregnant. They're more likely to require IVF, for example. When you treat endometriosis and when you treat it surgically, and if you can improve the overall endometriosis condition that that woman has, you improve her chances of getting pregnant naturally. And you also improve the likelihood that IVF will work if that's what she's going to do.
That's interesting. So that brings us on then to the surgery that you do. So you do, this is what your fellowship was in, and this is what really what your specialist interest is in. So I suppose, firstly, we can talk about other options as well for treatment of endometriosis, but because not every woman with endometriosis will require surgery. But can you just talk us through the surgery that you offer and how it can help women who have endometriosis?
So firstly, when it comes to surgery, women may already have tried multiple non-surgical treatments. It's generally speaking going to be a laparoscopy. It's rare that it'll be open surgery.
So that's keyhole.
Keyhole surgery. And the first part of that is diagnostic. You're doing a thorough examination of the pelvis and the abdomen inside to see is there endometriosis or not. And it can have a variety of different appearances. So it's, you know, it's important that it's a kind of a quite a thorough inspection. So usually that's going to be a small cut, maybe half a centimetre at the belly button. And there may be two or three other small cuts lower down in on the tummy, just to put in instruments to move things like bowel out of the way and have a good look around. So that's the first part of the procedure, a diagnostic laparoscopy. So just investigative keyhole surgery. The second part of it then, if you do find endometriosis, is to treat that. And there's two ways that you can treat it. You can treat it by ablation or you can treat it by excision. And there's a lot of conversation out there about which is better. And my personal preference is excision. But we don't actually have fantastic evidence that it is superior to ablation. But the purpose of both is really to remove or destroy any active endometriosis tissue. While obviously preserving everything that's important for fertility, if that's important, such as fallopian tubes and ovaries.
So ablation is kind of more like a burning of the tissue. So it's burning it away with a surgical instrument, and then excision is cutting it out. So and that's what your fellowship was in, isn't it? For it was the cutting away of the endometriosis.
That was certainly the primary method that we used at Monash, where I trained. What I suppose sees the benefits are is that you, when you remove tissue, you can have it examined in the lab, and that's often very useful. Sometimes just looking at tissue by the naked eye, you're not sure, is this inflammation from some other cause or is this endometriosis? And that's a valuable thing to do. Also, I find it easier to know that I've completed the procedure, that I don't have any other remaining tissue. When you ablate, it's possible that you're only treating a superficial element of the disease and not the deeper disease. It's fantastic to be able to give people a clear-cut diagnosis and there's no doubt about it.
I think psychologically speaking, I know if it was me, I think psychologically you'd prefer to know that it was excised, if you know, and then Absolutely. And then you have the diagnosis.
Yeah. And I believe the kind of response from patients in terms of relief in their symptoms, I believe, is better. Now, there are some good studies ongoing at the moment to kind of once and for all answer this mm-hmm. about superficial disease, mm-hmm. about which is best. And I think we'll have some really good information
yeah.
on that in the next couple of years.
Yes, I was going to say at the start when we first started discussing this that research is so important for endometriosis, isn't it? You know, just in terms of finding out what exactly is causing it and, you know, the best treatment option. So if a woman or if a person with endometriosis has surgery, so you said there actually that if they then need help with becoming pregnant or they need IVF, the surgery will improve their chances of conceiving?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and judging by how much endometriosis there is, and very importantly, how well the fallopian tubes function. So usually at the same time, I'll do a dye test where I put some dye through the tubes and I watch it coming through, and that confirms that the tubes are open. So when you, and so that, knowing that and combined with how much endometriosis there was and the fact you've removed it all, you can kind of give people an estimation of their likelihood of conceiving naturally.
Yes.
So it's a really useful tool. It's called the Endometriosis Fertility Index. So I often use that to give women an idea of what their expectations should be.
Yeah. Well, that's very nice, and that gives people hope, you know. And hope is quite powerful when it comes to fertility. So, in terms of this surgical procedure that you do, you know, do you think are there enough services available for people who suffer with endometriosis in Ireland?
Absolutely not. There really isn't. Really isn't enough. I think we're improving the services. I think we're, you know, the number of people interested in it is growing, I hope. But we absolutely need more. And we need a variety of services. We need, you know, in terms of gynecologists, we need more who are interested in it and willing to do it. We need people who are, say, interested in diagnosing it. We need people who are interested in treating kind of the mild, moderate disease. And, of course, people who have resources to focus on severe disease. We need other specialists to be involved. We need sometimes bowel surgeons or urology surgeons to help in some instances. We need physiotherapists.
Yes. Yeah.
Psychologists.
Yes.
And so on. Specialist nurses to kind of help coordinate everything. It would really be the central players in all this.
Yes.
And we need to try and kind of integrate as much of this into one, under one roof as much as possible, and multidisciplinary care.
Yeah, I've never thought about endometriosis in that way, in such a multidisciplinary way. Did they have that in Australia where you were training?
We did, and it was quite good. And we had a kind of an excellent, really good unit where they had kind of, we had everything from naturopaths to psychologists, and we were all kind of under one roof, all sitting at the same clinic, actually, which was fantastic. And there was really good communication between all the different branches of the team.
I've never thought about it in that way, and that does sound like the ideal service, doesn't it? Yeah, to have your, you know, your specialist nurse, as you know, because they're so useful as first port of contact for patients and psychological support. I'd never thought about it in that way. So hopefully that's the ideal way that things would be for endometriosis in Ireland.
And, you know, we're used to multidisciplinary teams. We've, I think in the last 15, 20 years in Ireland, we've become excellent at delivering cancer care in that way.
Yeah.
And I think we just need a similar mindset in how we look at endometriosis.
Absolutely. Just change the mindset a little bit. So are there any non-surgical options? So I suppose there might be people who have endometriosis who might be may not require surgery. So are there any options for people who, I suppose, other treatment options for endometriosis rather than surgery?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, not every woman out there with some pelvic pain should think that she has to have a laparoscopy. That, you know, that isn't always the case. Non-surgical options, first and foremost, you can treat the pain. You know, you use non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, so things like ibuprofen and drugs like that, which can really just help limit the pain. Using things like physiotherapy, so just non-medical aspects like that, and that can really help deal with the pain, and particularly some of the pain around intercourse can be really improved by pelvic floor work.
Yes.
Hormonal options, so hormonal drugs. The most common one that's used will be the combined oral contraceptive pill, and that can be quite effective, that can be quite useful, or the progesterone only pill as well, which can also be quite effective. And even if I perform the surgery, I will still say we should follow it up with a hormonal option to suppress further disease down the line.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I suppose so those options will be then, the hormonal options will be for women who are not trying to conceive.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the progesterone, it can be given also in the form of a coil, which is fitted inside the womb. And, you know, that can be a fantastic option for particularly women who want, you know, kind of want more medium to long term control. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Another drug that's talked a lot about a lot are what's known as GnRH analogs. And these are usually by injection, but they aim to kind of induce a temporary menopause. And there's a lot of concern about amongst women, understandably, kind of using them. It's not something you'd often do without a diagnosis or anything.
Yeah.
It's often something you might do where there's severe disease and you might give it for a while to try and deactivate disease as much as possible before embarking on some complicated surgery. So that's probably the most common situation where you might use it.
Okay. Just going back as well, what you said, pain relief, actually. Good point. In the first instance, you know, if you have pain, take some pain relief. And it's the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that are best for this type of pain. Is there a way that you recommend to take them, you know, when you get pain, before you get pain, when you expect in your cycle? Is there any recommended way to take them or just as required?
I prefer to take that people take them regularly. And take it in conjunction with paracetamol regularly. And when you use kind of different drugs which work differently, they're more effective combined. Don't wait for pain, I say. And most of the women I deal with who have endometriosis or might have it, they know their pattern so well. And they'll almost know to the day when they're going to get pain. And if you know that the first day of your period or the second day is, you know, where, you're in a lot of pain and you find it difficult to leave the house, then don't wait for pain. Start your pain relief.
Yeah.
Keep taking it regularly.
Yeah. It's like I'm hearing myself back now, because that's what I say like again and again and again about all management of pain. You know, don't wait for pain. Take the paracetamol and the anti-inflammatories. But, you know, that's unusual. It's a hard sell sometimes, actually, for people, because people feel like they're, you know, relying on pain relief. But, you know, if you have pain, you know, take the pain relief. You know, I certainly do. If I have pain, I take the pain relief, you know. And the important message there that you said as well about paracetamol and the anti-inflammatory, it's like the 1+1 kind of equals three effect.
Absolutely.
So, and as you say, it's all women know their cycle. They know when they're going to get pain, for the most part.
Yeah.
So, you know, just, you know, obviously safely with your GP or your gynecologist, ask about pain relief, but not to be shy or frightened about it as well, you know, if you need pain relief.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, can we talk a little bit about endometriosis and pregnancy?
Okay.
So do the symptoms go away when the person is pregnant?
Women with endometriosis have often been told, maybe more so in the past, that if you have endometriosis, go and get pregnant and that will get rid of it. And that's quite a frustrating thing to say to a woman. But it is true that a lot of the endometriosis symptoms improve during pregnancy. Because during pregnancy, obviously, there's no ovulation. So you don't have that cycle, which is giving you that monthly pattern of pain, of activation of the endometriosis. So it often improves. However, if a woman has substantial endometriosis and she has big endometriomas and big nodules in her pelvis, they obviously haven't gone away. And they can certainly cause pain and discomfort during pregnancy. And as her womb is growing substantially during pregnancy, if there's adhesions in there, that can cause, you know, ongoing pain during pregnancy. And, you know, occasionally you can have ruptures of cysts, and that can mimic emergencies that look like pregnancy-related emergencies. So it can be, it's something that I think that when we're looking after pregnant women, we have to remember her gynecological history. As well as what's going on purely during the pregnancy. And it can also, at times, you know, it needs to be remembered at time of delivery.
I was just going to ask,
My preference, I suppose, if a woman has endometriosis, I know that, is that preferentially she would have a vaginal delivery.
Okay.
Simply, and that won't always be possible. But that, I suppose, when you do a cesarean, you're opening the abdomen, and that is a form of, you know, a trauma in itself, which can be, isn't ideal when there's endometriosis. And it's possible as well for endometriosis to transfer from the pelvis into the cesarean scar. And some women after who've had a cesarean will get monthly pain and even bleeding from their cesarean scars. And that can be a bit tricky to treat. So if they do need a cesarean, there's a, you know, a few steps I do at the time to try and kind of reduce the risk of that happening.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting point. And as well, you know, it's open surgery, so your risk of, you know, further pelvic pain and adhesions afterwards. But, you know, either way, I suppose baby just has to be delivered in the safest way possible as well. But it's interesting, that you say, and it makes perfect sense that ideally, preferentially, it would be a vaginal delivery where possible. And then, so what about then, I suppose, the postpartum period and then thinking about expanding family? Because we always, I did a podcast on fertility and it was Laura Hackett, she's a fertility specialist nurse at the Waterstone Clinic. And she said, which I think is so right, is that there's loads of focus on the first baby, you know, and it's the first baby and everybody focuses on that. But then there's less of a focus on secondary infertility, not being able to have a baby after you've had your first baby, or, you know, a delay to become pregnant. So, you know, if a person has just had their baby, you know they have endometriosis, what advice do you have for them?
Yeah, because women often, they've had such a long journey potentially getting the point of getting pregnant and now having this baby, and it's all their energy is focused on this, and you know, and rightly so. But I often ask women, how many babies do they think they'd like? Do they think they'd like to have a second baby or potentially a third baby? And if so, we know that endometriosis affects fertility, but this woman has gotten pregnant, whether it's naturally or by IVF. So her situation must be good enough that she's able to get pregnant. But we don't know, will that be still true in 5 years or 6 years? So while you know that she's, her and her husband are fertile, it's, you know, why not try and have the next baby sooner rather than later? Obviously within reason. I also think that if women breastfeed, it continues. If they've had relief from their symptoms during pregnancy, if they breastfeed, they're more likely to get that benefit lasting longer.
Oh, interesting.
Because again, women aren't ovulating when they're breastfeeding. It's between babies before they're ready to try to become pregnant again. I think it might be worthwhile that they consider taking hormonal contraception. I often would prescribe a progesterone only pill because they can breastfeed if they wish alongside that.
Yes, and that's, so people often call that the mini pill.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah, so that's a nice interim kind of contraception method if you're not ready to go straight away again. So can we talk as well just about menopause and endometriosis? Mm-hmm. So that's the, I suppose, I'm going to do another podcast with Dr. Deirdre Lundy on menopause. So menopause really is it's the stopping of the monthly menstrual cycle. Will that solve your symptoms and solve the problem of endometriosis?
For many, it will. Endometriosis is driven by estrogen, which is produced by the ovaries. And when women go through menopause, their ovaries stop producing estrogen. So it's logical that the endometriosis will get better and the symptoms will go. It's not always the case. firstly, I suppose if a woman has a considerable amount of disease, lots of scar tissue in her pelvis, then that might still cause her pain and discomfort, even though it's not necessarily active anymore.
Yes.
Because her pelvis is still distorted by it. Also, endometriosis can have an ability to produce its own estrogen source.
I never
and
knew
be
that.
A self-sustaining condition.
God.
And there's a medication, it's a, the type of medication is called an aromatase inhibitor, and that can sometimes be useful to interrupt that process, that that endogenous estrogen.
That's so interesting. It can produce its own estrogen. That's incredible.
And obviously women who are going through the menopause or have gone through menopause will often be discussing with their GP about should they take HRT. If you've endometriosis, you can take HRT. Women who've had a hysterectomy will often take estrogen-only HRT rather than estrogen mixed with progesterone HRT.
Yeah.
I tell women who have endometriosis that they should only take the combined HRT with estrogen and progesterone, because estrogen-only could aggravate any residual endometriosis further.
Yes.
So even if they've no womb,
yeah,
they should still take combined HRT, in my opinion.
That's really interesting and great for me to know as well. So thank you for that. So then this is what I get asked a lot. And this, I suppose a lot of people, they want to do things as naturally as possible, you know, as much as they can, or in addition to what, you know, any medications or treatments that they're having. Are there any lifestyle measures, diet recommendations, supplements, alternative treatment options? Because people really, I suppose they want to do everything they can and know that they're doing the right thing. So is there anything at all that is recommended that can help the symptoms?
There's quite an overlap with endometriosis and the symptoms it causes and irritable bowel.
Yeah.
And irregular bowel habit in that. And I find that women with that will often find that there's triggers in their diet that make these things worse. And very simply, healthy diets suit women better. Avoiding too much alcohol, too much coffee, sometimes red meats. Reducing their gluten intake can help. Which, looking at will a diet improve endometriosis itself? Nothing has been kind of proven in a kind of robust scientific way to do that. It's quite individual. And I think it's always worthwhile involving a dietitian in that multidisciplinary group.
Yes.
And exploring options. But I suppose what works for one woman might not be the same for another.
It's I mean, because that's the way it is with IBS as well. What some person's triggers for IBS will be completely different for somebody else. So yeah, adding a dietitian to the MDT, that's a great idea as well. Was there a dietitian in the MDT in Australia?
We did, yeah.
God,
yeah,
okay, so it was like the dream team.
Yes.
Okay, okay, so that's the way things need to be going here. Then what about supplements? That's I'm asked all the time as well.
I can't say that there's a single supplement that's been proven scientifically that it works. But, you know, again, some people will swear by various supplements. And that's great. If they find something that works, that's brilliant, and I'm very supportive of it. And hopefully we will have, you know, some evidence, some good research that shows us some supplements in the future.
It's occurring to me here now that I'm asking a surgeon about supplements, but you know, anyway, it's important to ask these questions. And then what about alternative treatment options like acupuncture? Can that help, and is there any evidence to support it?
I think people can really find acupuncture particularly useful. Acupuncture, physiotherapy, psychology. I think, you know, learning how to kind of manage your pain and your symptoms on a kind of mental and emotional level, I think is really important.
Yeah, Because it's when it's severe disease, as you said at the start, it's your whole life. You know, it's going to work, coming under pressure at work because of missed days or, you know, missing school or, you know, exams in younger people. The effect on relationships, trying to conceive. So there's that psychological and emotional burden with it as well. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And I think the goal is to get to a point where endometriosis isn't dominating your life. Not that you forget about it or anything. That's still there. It'll still need to be given some attention, be managed. But that is not the dominant thing in your life.
Sure, that it's not impacting your quality of life, and that you have a good quality of life. Is there anything that we've missed in terms of endometriosis that you think we should highlight today? Is there any other important messages you'd like to share?
I often get asked about hysterectomy. People often, and when they come to me, they might have been seeing several other people, might have been waiting several, kind of dealing with this for many years, and they're very frustrated, and often said, I just want it all out. I want a hysterectomy.
Yeah, so taking out the womb. Yeah.
Taking out the womb. Yeah. And that's, I suppose, not always the solution. For classically, endometriosis, which is outside the womb, it's around the pelvis, is not actually cured by doing a hysterectomy, by taking the womb. Now, where there's adenomyosis, where you've got that condition which is really affecting the muscle of the womb, yes, a hysterectomy in that situation can be it can be potentially a curative operation.
Okay.
So it's I think I understand people's frustration when they say, I want hysterectomy, but it's not always the answer.
And I understand that the psychological kind of component of that as well. You know, often what women say to me, I just want to take it out, just take it out, you know. But that's an important point, that endometriosis isn't only affecting the womb. Then in terms of adenomyosis, sorry, I'm going back now to adenomyosis. How is that diagnosed?
It's really underdiagnosed.
Yeah.
The history can be suggestive. As I said, it's not just painful periods, but it's often the periods are heavy as well. Difficulty conceiving, bleeding between periods, pain after intercourse, not just during it. Often a central kind of crampy pain in their pelvis afterwards.
Okay, so is that in the hours afterwards or the days? Or
usually it's in kind of minutes and hours.
Okay, after. That's interesting. Afterwards. Okay.
So that's really useful. Often when you examine, they'll have a bulkier than normal womb. And it might be just tender to touch it. Scans can be useful. There's some hallmark signs on ultrasound or on MRI, but they probably do miss some of the more subtle forms of it, unfortunately. And the most common place it's diagnosed is a woman has a hysterectomy, and it's the pathologist in the lab who examines her womb, and they see it.
Yeah. Because I imagine if I referred for an ultrasound or an MRI and I didn't specifically say, can you look for adenomyosis, then the radiologist might not be examining it, you know what I mean? Yeah, so I need to specifically say that.
I think that's helpful. I think somebody who's you know, a well-trained eye needs to have a good look at it to improve your chances of diagnosis.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you so much for all of that information today. I think it really helped people, and I've certainly learned a lot today as well, which I love doing these podcasts because I get all of this CPD and then I can bring it back to my patients. So thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to us today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Patients would like to see you, would like a consultation with you. How do they see you?
If people would like to look at my website, it's www.drhughoconnor.com. That'll give them all the information they need about how they can get a referral. Usually they need their GP to write them a referral letter. And I'm happy to see anyone who might have endometriosis or knows they have endometriosis or a variety of other gynecological conditions.
Yes. Yeah. Your website is brilliant, actually. It's a lovely website, and it goes through all of the gynecological conditions that you treat, and as well, you're an obstetrician as well.
Absolutely. Thank
you. For good measure.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast, which was kindly sponsored by Boyne Valley Honey. Boyne Valley Honey is Ireland's favourite honey brand, and you can follow them on Instagram at Boyne Valley Honey for inspiration on how to incorporate honey into a part of your daily healthy routine.